The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
And the second thing he's trying to do is intimidate prosecutors. But this is a different prosecutor in Jack Smith. This is a person who prosecuted and convicted war criminals in The Hague. This is a man who cannot be intimidated. So I think Donald Trump has met his match.
Which is, we're talking here about federal charges. We're talking about what Jack Smith, the special counsel, is going to bring on behalf of the United States Justice Department. There's also a separate set of investigations going on in Georgia and perhaps other states about Trump's fraud around January 6th, the fake electors plot and stuff like that. So you could see Trump facing, for the same basic conduct, trials going on in Georgia at the state level and with Jack Smith at the federal level, conceivably in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. I think the bottom line here is I think it's quite clear that Donald Trump is going to double his current number of indictments in the near future.
Polling over the last several months indicates that with each new indictment, Trump's popularity grows among his extremist Republican base. Considering all these factors, prosecuting this particular former president becomes an entirely different ballgame. However, it is a ballgame that it is entirely necessary to play. Excusing the behavior of a defiant and habitual lawbreaker with fascist ambitions would raise serious questions about the integrity of our democratic system, and it could undermine the very bedrock of our democratic principles.
What we do know is that indictments don't hurt him, they help him.
Well, to your point about the polls, I want to say that I do think that Donald Trump is stronger than he was politically in 2016. I mean, the odds markets had him at 9% of winning the presidency in 2016. Right now, the betting markets have him at something like 30% or above. And it's confounding, I think, to a lot of people that the twice indicted, soon to be probably thrice indicted, Donald Trump would be the leader in the field.
He is crushing everyone in Iowa and South Carolina. I mean, there's just no way around it. I mean, the polls are obvious.
I said, can you be president from jail? You're the expert, but the answer that I've been getting so far is, yeah, maybe you could run the country from jail.
There you go. An all-star cast, the talking heads weighing in on Donald Trump's rising popularity, even though he's met his match. Jack Smith, he's there. He's the one that's going to take down Trump. And yet they acknowledge this. Many of the same ones acknowledge that maybe he'll even be president from jail. Who knows? You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on this good Monday morning or whatever it is in the time zone that you're listening from. You can get to the live video stream of this show at trumpetdaily.com. Just go to trumpetdaily.com every weekday morning at 11 a.m. in the central time zone of these United States, or maybe what used to be United States. You can also go to our Rumble channel. That would be The Trumpet Daily. Just search for The Trumpet Daily over at Rumble and subscribe to the channel. Join the conversation every day. The live audience is available there. Of course, you can get to the live, or rather the podcasts that are posted after the fact at both of those websites as well. So the New York Times on this oncoming Jack Smith indictment, the one who frequents Subway, the sandwich shop here in the United States. The New York Times says that they're blowing the dust off of a Civil War era statute to go after Trump. It says here, federal prosecutors have introduced a new twist in the January 6th investigation by suggesting it in a target letter that they could charge former President Donald Trump with violating a civil rights statute. Civil rights statute that dates back to the post-Civil War, both, I guess, post-Civil War Reconstruction era, according to three people familiar with the matter. So however you can take them down, I mean, they blew the dust off the Logan Act to go after Flynn. They blew the dust off the Espionage Act. I think that was a World War II era statute on the books. They blew the dust off that one to get him for moving boxes. Yeah, espionage. He's a spy. And now they're going all the way back to the Civil War era, the Reconstruction era, and they're going to get Trump on some kind of treasonous activity, some kind of conspiracy to overthrow the government. The New York Times says here, the letter to Mr. Trump from the special counsel, Jack Smith, referred to three criminal statutes as part of the grand jury investigation into Mr. Trump's efforts to reverse his 2020 election loss, according to two people with the knowledge of its contents. Yeah, I mean, he's trying to overthrow the government. He was so dangerous that come January 20th, when Joe Biden was to move in, Donald Trump just quietly walked out of the White House and flew to Mar-a-Lago. He went home. That's right. This is the dangerous conspirator that they want to put in prison for the rest of his life. It says here, but the third criminal law cited in the letter was a surprise. Lots of surprises, lots of new legal theory at work with these prosecutors that hate Trump. It says here, Section 241 of Title 18 of the U.S. Code, which makes it a crime for people to conspire to injure, oppress, threaten, or intimidate any person in the free exercise or enjoyment of any right or privilege secured to him by the Constitution. It says Congress enacted that statute after the Civil War to provide a tool for federal agents to go after Southern whites, including the Ku Klux, the KKK, the tongue twister, members who engaged in terrorism to prevent formerly enslaved African Americans from voting. So as I say, they take this out of the dustbin of history, and there it is. Some are surprised by this, that they would use such an arcane law to, but yet again, this is no surprise. See the Logan Act, see the Espionage Act. Listen to this analysis, if you can call it that. This is from MSNBC, clip 7.
The former president will now apparently be indicted and prosecuted for his efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election and also for the attack on the United States Capitol on January 6. These are the gravest offenses against the United States that a president could commit, with the possible exception of treason itself. These offenses, though, partake of the betrayal of America that is the essence of treason. Neither this indictment nor the indictment over the classified documents would have ever come to pass if the former president had not wanted and forced Jack Smith and the Department of Justice to prosecute him. He wanted to be indicted and prosecuted, and finally Jack Smith had no choice but to indict the former president, lest he make a mockery out of the Constitution and the rule of law.
I don't even understand what he's trying to say, this guy. On the one hand, he says he's guilty of treason, the gravest offense. He's committed this crime, this guy says. And then in the very next sentence, he says here, neither this indictment, the one speaking of the January 6th protest and the so-called attempt to overthrow the government, neither this indictment nor the indictment over the classified documents would have ever come to pass if the former president had not wanted and forced Jack Smith to bring this on him. So if he's guilty of treason, I mean, treason is treason. The charges should have come forward maybe a year and a half ago. You're talking about something that happened 2.5 years ago. And this guy right here that you see on the screen is saying that Trump's guilty of treason, but he could have avoided the indictment altogether. I guess he wanted it. Jack Smith had no choice. He was forced. It's almost like Jack Smith is a victim here. He had no choice but to bring the indictment over treason. How do these people even make it on? This guy's a judge, I think. How do they make it on TV? And how about the divining a motive? They know exactly what's going on in Trump's mind. He wanted the indictment, don't you know? He wants to go to prison. That's analysis over at MSNBC. And then the New York Times, they're surprised. Yeah, they're pulling this Civil War era statute out of the dustbin of history to go after Trump on this. It really is pretty amazing. This is from The Guardian. The Fulton County District Attorney investigating Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the... Don't forget about the attempt in Georgia. They're going to get him... There's probably two more indictments coming, at least. He'll have four going into next year's election. It says here, the Fulton County District Attorney investigating Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election results in the state of Georgia has developed evidence to charge a sprawling racketeering indictment next month, according to two people briefed on the matter. So he's guilty now of racketeering, treason, racketeering, espionage, and then the clerical error on the accounting. Don't forget about that one. It says here, the racketeering statute in Georgia requires prosecutors to show the existence of an enterprise and a pattern of racketeering activity that is predicated on at least two qualifying crimes. Really testing the legal theories here. Got to get him. Get Trump. Get Trump. That's all that it amounts to. As long as you take down Trump, we'll find the law that he broke for sure. It says here, in the Trump investigation, the Fulton County District Attorney, Fannie Willis, has evidence to pursuing a racketeering indictment predicated on statutes related to influencing witnesses and computer trespass. So he's influencing witnesses, and he's also committed trespass on a computer, whatever that means. It's just unbelievable. All of these charges, and like I said, he leaves peacefully on January 20th, 2021. He just walks out of the White House, and he heads off to Florida, where he's been ever since. But the persecution, it never stops. This is from America Under Attack. It says, depending on how you... Here's the book, by the way. Call our operators today, 1-866-930-3024, and request your free hardcover version of America Under Attack. My father says here, depending on how you count it, the Department of Justice investigation lasted between, this is talking about the Mueller investigation, 22 months and at least 3 years, most of the president's first term before it finally closed. These people spent years pressuring, intimidating, and spying on those connected to the president. They entrapped his national security advisor, raided the home, office, hotel, and safe deposit boxes of the president's personal lawyer. Intimidated dozens of people. Who's intimidating who? Who's intimidating witnesses here? Intimidated dozens of people with indictments and threats of indictments. And in the end, see the process. The process is the punishment. Just threaten them. Just throw out indictments like ham sandwiches. No problem. It says here, they provided zero evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russian operatives. Zero. Zero evidence. The investigation went on for something like 3 years, and they turned up nothing. Nothing with a capital N. Nothing. Zero. Zero evidence. But that didn't stop them from intimidating and harassing, spying, cheating, lying, stealing. It says here, the Trump-Russia investigation lasted 2 years and cost $40 million. The radical left did all they could to use it to cripple the Trump presidency. The entire investigation was based on that filthy, worthless dossier and thus was totally fraudulent from the very beginning. Just like all these indictments, the indictments spring from this kind of attack. America's under attack. It says here, it was all to attack Donald Trump, and perhaps more importantly, to distract from and cover up their own criminal treasonous activity. To cover up their own treason. They're there on TV saying, yeah, well, with Donald Trump, it was the spirit of treason, what happened 2.5 years ago. But, he could have avoided the indictment if he just would have cooperated with Jack Smith. Oh, okay, so then you just brush aside the treason? These people, they're deranged in their obsession to take down Trump. They're also deranged in their reasoning. It just changes from one day to the next. You never know what they're going to say. You never know what kind of motive they're going to divine. Donald Trump wanted this indictment. Oh, okay. I got it. Sure. Don Jr. over the... You look at all these revelations about the Biden crime syndicate. He tweeted out over the weekend that his father, Donald Trump, was impeached for what the Biden family was doing and is doing in Ukraine. This is where we are in the upside down world. Donald Trump got, you know, he got impeached for doing what Joe Biden did. Intimidating, holding back $1 billion, quid pro quo, taking bribes. It's all coming out. This is from Newt Gingrich over the weekend, clip three.
Look, I mean, every week we get more information. Every week the information corroborates what we've already suspected. What this says to me is that it's very possible that there was a direct payment to the then Vice President of the United States. It's certainly even more likely that there were payments that were funneled through Hunter to Joe Biden. And the evidence just keeps mounting up every single week. At some point, the dam is going to break, and even the New York Times and the Washington Post are going to recognize that we have a huge problem on our hands. We may have a criminal family sitting in the White House that took money from foreigners in Kazakhstan, Ukraine, Romania, Russia, and China.
Ukraine, Russia, and China? There's a couple of others too. Romania, Kazakhstan, but Russia and China? Oh, yes. Evidence just keeps pouring forth. Miranda Devine, she's got a piece in the New York Post this morning anticipating the testimony of Devin Archer. He was a business partner of Hunter's. I have to give you a lot of this because the detail here, I mean, it just kind of makes your head spin. You read this, as I told Sam earlier today, and you think, how is Joe Biden, at the very least, how is Joe Biden not impeached already? Given what we've heard from the IRS whistleblowers, given what was revealed from the FBI 1023, given what we're hearing from other witnesses now like Devin Archer, given what we know from Tony Bobulinski, given what's right there on Hunter's laptop, a laptop the FBI's had since 2019. Can you believe this? Miranda says Hunter Biden would dial in his father, then Vice President Joe Biden, on speakerphone into meetings with his overseas business partners, according to testimony expected before Congress this week from Devin Archer, the first son's former best friend. The Hunter's bestie, that's right. He's now coming forward. He's now giving us some insights in how the big guy ran the family business. Remember, the big guy denied for years he never spoke to Hunter once about Hunter's business practices. It says here, Archer, who's facing jail for his role in a $60 million bond fraud, is scheduled to testify to the House Oversight Committee about meetings he witnessed that were attended by Joe Biden, either in person or via speakerphone, when Hunter would call his father and introduce him to foreign business partners or prospective investors. Vice President Joe was running the business. He's the kingpin of the family. Of course, above that, you've got the dear leader, Barack Obama. He's always left out of these kinds of stories. He gets a pass. He's the dear leader. People still swoon before him. All this was happening under Obama's watch. You think Obama and his people and his investigators, you think they didn't know that Joe Biden was on the phone with some of these foreign nationals coming from even adversarial nations? It says here, soon afterward, the two Ukrainians, is further on. Well, let me just back up. It says here, one such meeting was in Dubai late in the evening of Friday, December 4th, 2015. I mean, we know the date. We know the evening. We know it was in Dubai. Says here, after a board meeting of the Ukrainian energy company Burisma, which was paying Hunter $83,000 a month as a director. And we would add here that at this point in his life, Hunter was a crackhead and a whoremonger. Okay, both of those. But evidently, Burisma paid him $83,000 per month because they valued his input. They valued his contribution to the oil and gas company. It says here, soon afterward, the two Ukrainians joined Hunter and Archer at the Four Seasons bar, and Pozarsky asked Hunter, he's the Burisma rep, can you ring your dad? At the time, it was early afternoon Friday in Washington, D.C. Can you call up the big guy? Can you call up Joe Biden, the vice president of the United States, the one that's working there in Obama's White House? Who's guilty of treason here? Who's a danger, a threat to the country? Who sold out the United States of America? Says here, Hunter then called his father, put him on speaker, placed the phone on the table, and introduced the Ukrainians to Joe Biden by name as Nikolai and Vadim. These are business partners. It says here, he also said words to the effect that the Burisma bigwigs need our support. Congressional investigators are expected to probe the reasons for Zlochevsky's requesting the urgent phone call with Joe Biden. So they're going to piece the timing together, and Miranda Devine's already done a bit of that here with this article. It says they will note the context that 3 days after the speakerphone call, the then vice president, who was the Obama administration's point man for Ukraine, at least Obama's mentioned here, was due to fly to Kiev to address the Ukrainian parliament known as the Rada on December 9th, 2015, about the poison of cronyism, corruption, and kleptocracy. You can't make this up. Biden had more interest in Ukraine, in keeping the crimes going and the money flowing, than he did in serving the United States of America as vice president. He even, when he bragged about withholding the billion, I think in that same that same soundbite, he talks about going over to Kiev 16, 17 times. What is going on? This is back at a time when most people, they weren't even familiar with where Ukraine was on a map. He leaves for Kiev. He talks about the poison of cronyism. And it says 10 weeks before the call, on September 24th, 2015, Ambassador Jeffrey Pyatt had given a speech about corruption in Odessa, in which he targeted Zelensky by name. By then, it says Ukrainian Prosecutor General Viktor Shokin was investigating Burisma for corruption. Within 2 months, on February 2nd, 2016, would seize four houses in Kiev, two plots of land, and a Rolls Royce belonging to Zlochevsky. I can't say my Z's today. But he's the head of Burisma, it says, who was living in exile in Dubai. It says a month later, listen to this, the phone call, the investigation's going on through the end of 2015. The phone call with the Burisma reps with Joe Biden. That's in early December 2015. Then a few days later, Joe Biden is in. He's in Ukraine lecturing them about cronyism and such. And then just a couple months later, guess what happens? A month later, Shokin was fired after Joe Biden threatened to withhold $1 billion in U.S. aid to Ukraine. Donald Trump was impeached for what Joe Biden and company did in Ukraine. For sure. For sure. Says here, this is the rest of her article, as Shokin's probe gathered speed at the end of 2015, Pozarsky ratcheted up the pressure on Hunter. Emails on Hunter's laptop show. In an email to Hunter and Archer on November 2nd, 2015, so this would have been about a month before the phone call that involved the big guy, 1 month before the speaker phone call, Pozarsky explicitly demanded that they use their influence to, quote, close down the criminal investigation against Burisma. You put the phone calls together with the emails, together with the Hunter laptop, together with what Bob Alinsky has testified, and now Devin Archer. Says here, Archer's also expected to detail other speakerphone meetings in his testimony. Hunter performed the same party trick, well, where Hunter would say, hey, I'll get my phone out and get my dad on the line if need be. Hunter performed the same party trick as many as two dozen times in Archer's presence. The Long Island-born father of three is expected to tell Congress. Another former business partner, Tony Bob Alinsky, recalls Hunter offering to get his father on the phone during a meeting by the pool at the Chateau Marmont in L.A., says since news broke that Archer would testify before the Republican-controlled committee, his family has been receiving death threats and warnings to keep your mouth shut. Well, that's no big surprise. I mean, you've got the mafia. You've got this crime family. They're being exposed. It only follows that they're going to threaten and intimidate witnesses. You'll notice that they're trying to go after Trump on that. In Georgia, they're guilty of everything they're projecting at Donald Trump, of everything they're throwing at Donald Trump. They are guilty of those crimes. It says during about one quarter of the speakerphone calls witnessed by Archer, Hunter would introduce his father to the foreigners with whom he was transacting business. I keep thinking of Joe Biden over and over again. I knew nothing about my son's business dealings. His son is the smartest guy he knows. I knew nothing. I never talked to him once. It says here, but at other times, he would just speak to Joe without, look at, listen to this, and just think about for national security's sake alone, where was the DOJ? Where was the FBI? Where was Obama? At other times, he would just speak to Joe without acknowledging that other people were listening in. So it's not clear how often Vice President Biden was aware that he was being used as leverage by his son. He'd just get his dad on the, he's, I think, said in other interviews, even to this day, he's on the phone with his dad every day. He's in contact with his dad every day. Well, when they're raking in $5 million here, $10 million here, you can be sure they're on the phone a lot. But Miranda Devine is saying sometimes Joe was on the phone and he didn't even realize that Hunter's business partners were listening in. These people, these foreign nationals from Ukraine, from Russia, from the CCP, from Romania, from Kazakhstan. It says here in the FBI document, well, let me back up. Archer also expressed is expected to testify about two dinners Hunter organized for his VP father to meet business partners from Ukraine, Russia, and Kazakhstan in a private room at Georgetown in April 2015 and another in early 2016. Joe Biden repeatedly has said he knew nothing about his son's overseas business dealings. In the FBI document, known as the 1023, Zlochevsky is quoted calling Joe the big guy. Archer's expected to testify that big guy was a nickname used by Hunter's business partners to refer to his father. Bob Alinsky also says Joe Biden is the big guy. There's quite a few witnesses lining up. Witnesses that are coming under threat. Witnesses that are being intimidated to keep their mouths shut. It says here finally, in a notorious 2017 email, to Hunter and Bob Alinsky, their business partner James Gillier outlined percentage equity breakdowns of a joint venture with Chinese firm CEFC with 10% held for the big guy. It says the identity of the big guy also formed part of the grand jury investigation in Wilmington, Delaware, into Hunter's business dealings. Unbelievable article. And I'm sure we'll have some, if she's spot on with all this, I'm sure we'll have some sound bites from Devin Archer later this week. Listen to this rep, this Republican rep, talking about this Biden crime syndicate earlier today, clip 8.
It's going to come time for the Democrats to actually say, this is worse than Watergate. I mean, as I've said on numerous occasions, you know, Richard Nixon didn't commit a crime. The people with him did. He covered it up. Joe Biden and his family are committing crimes and he's covering it up. We've never had this happen in American history where the DOJ and the FBI is so dirty and Merrick Garland is such a dirty cop that they're actually protecting crime. I mean, their job is to uncover crime.
Their job is to uncover crime. Instead, they're covering it up. This is so much worse than Watergate, as she notes there. They're committing crimes, crimes of treason. This is where the real conspiracy is. Crimes of treason, and then the cops are so dirty that they get away with it. And then the Republicans, so weak, they can't even impeach. You think they'd be tripping over themselves this morning after reading Miranda Devine's article saying we've got to prepare some articles of impeachment. This is outrageous. This man's now the president of the United States. Fake one at that, but the president of the United States and his family and Hunter's living in the White House at the moment? And bags of cocaine are just magically floating in? Who has the courage to do anything except for Donald Trump? He's exposing it every day. He's telling you what's actually happening here. And all the other Republican candidates, they just kind of dance around it. Even these bogus charges against Donald Trump. Well, you know, he should have been stronger on January 6th, but, you know, I don't think he necessarily should be indicted. That's so weak. It's pathetic. How about if you stand for something? How about if you expose the FBI agents that helped incite that riot? How about if you go and actually analyze the speech he gave at the Ellipse and see that he called for peace? How about if you look at his 4 years in office where there were no wars that America was entangled in? I mean, you could go right down the resume. And yet, instead, you get people saying stuff like, well, I mean, he could have avoided the indictment for treason. But, you know, he wanted to be indicted. Yeah, he wants to go to prison. Jack Smith had no choice. You know, Jack Smith has to give or file that indictment. Dirty cops all around D.C. This is from the Wall Street Journal. It says conservatives no longer trust the FBI. Liberals, or more precisely progressives, no longer trust local police. We have a problem. Yeah, where is this leading exactly? We may be inching closer than we imagine to the opposite of governing. Urban crime, mindless and random killings, tent city homelessness, parents shouting at school boards, and the images of an FBI raid on a former president's home. Instead of adjusting, many are turning away from the institutions that provide the bedrock of domestic tranquility. We're turning away. It's every man for himself, Judges 21:25. Every man doing what seems right in his own eyes. This is from Fox News regarding New York City. Speaking of urban crime and law enforcement, or lack thereof, New York City will give more than $13 million to more than 1,000 protesters arrested or interacting with police during the 2020 Black Lives Matter protests following a civil rights lawsuit settlement filed in Manhattan federal court Wednesday. The city is paying the Black Lives Matter rioters to the tune of $13 million. The people that smashed up businesses and burned buildings to the ground, they're receiving a settlement. They're receiving a pay from New York City. Says your expert said the settlement, which allows the city to avoid a trial, would be among the most expensive payouts ever for mass arrests. It just try to, again, follow the logic. A payout, a monetary payout for mass arrest. They're paying people that were arrested for rioting in the case of the Summer of Love. Certainly not for the January 6th protest. It says here, all protests, all riots are certainly not treated equal, are they? To avoid trial would be among the most expensive payouts ever for mass arrest. It still needs to be approved by a judge before it's finalized. Pretty amazing. CNN, this is California. California spent a stunning $17.5 billion trying to combat homelessness over just 4 years. $17 billion in 4 years? Over $4 billion per year to try to address the homelessness problem? What's happening to American cities? Says, across the country, homelessness is on the rise, but California is adding more homeless people every year than any other state. More than any other state? and they're throwing more than $4 billion at the crisis every year? It's not working. What's happening? How come the solutions that man puts forward, why are they not working? Well, like Isaiah 59 says regarding peace, there is a way to peace, but man doesn't know the way. As if we needed more evidence every day of this being Satan's world, of the world being cut off from the tree of life. Go back to the beginning of the book, Genesis 3. You see Adam and Eve choosing to partake of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And then God taking action. God took action and cut them off from the tree of life and said, all right, you go and you raise up your own societies. You raise up a system of education and business and commerce and religion even, and see how it works out for you. Well, we're seeing, we're getting a pretty good look at it every single day. You're listening to Stephen Flurry, and this is the Trumpet Daily. If you'd like to submit some feedback to the show, you can reach us at td@thetrumpet.com. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily. What has happened to the United States of America? The wealthiest, most powerful nation in human history is suddenly divided, weakened, radical. The evil in America has grown powerful. The good has grown weak. The honorable parts of American history are succumbing to a direct, targeted, sustained assault. Someone, something is dismantling America's history, purpose, and character.
Fundamentally transforming the United States of America.
Political dysfunction, social strife, economic peril, catastrophic moral failure, fires, attacks, riots, lies. The nation is being attacked from within by its own leaders. Powerful elites in government, journalism, academia, and beyond are intentionally, rapidly destroying what America is in order to make it into something else. There is a reason why your nation is crumbling before your eyes. There is a spirit and a specific perpetrator that is attempting to blot out America. Only America Under Attack reveals that perpetrator and the motive and spirit behind him. This newly expanded book shows you the reason why America has changed so dramatically, so suddenly. If you're confused and concerned about what is happening to America, request your free copy of America Under Attack by Gerald Flurry at thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
Earlier this year, the distinguished historian, the British historian Paul Johnson, he died. I think he was into his 90s. He lived a long life. Wrote lots of history books over the course of his long and fruitful and productive life. I think was fairly conservative, fairly reliably conservative. But he wrote an essay. This goes back to the year 2000. He wrote it back at the turn of the century, and he was just commenting in this essay on the decline of education. He said here that people are less intelligent than they used to be, and that this process has now been going on for a century or more. So all across the 1900s, a century, it says it's concealed by the myriad of aids to knowledge. So we've had all of these astounding leaps in progress, particularly with the development of the machine. I mean, you look at what some of the machines are able to do these days. Artificial intelligence, producing scripts, movie scripts, books, just creating almost. That's concealed a real problem in education. The fact that we're becoming dumber, basically. Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, used to talk about the great paradox of our time. He wrote a memorable piece back in the late 1960s. where he said it's like we're on a raft on an ocean, just surrounded by water, but none of it's good to drink. We've got all of this knowledge. We've got all of this technology. We've got all of these gadgets. I mean, people today, you have a smartphone in your back pocket. You're basically carrying with you a massive library, at least comparing it to the older days, days that I can remember before the computer, the desktop, the smartphone came along, and you actually had to go to the library to read and study. Paul Johnson says there was a time even before that where, you know, you basically, if you saw a classic text, you had to try to memorize or at least memorize the essence of it because there just weren't copies to go around. I mean, that's going back several centuries. In any event, he says in this essay, the reason for the decline of intelligence are many, but then can be summarized under one head, lack of use of large parts of the brain. It has been a continuing process for well over a century, but is now rapidly accelerating. I mean, he wrote this essay 23 years ago. It's rapidly accelerating. Look at the state of education today, as was brought out in one of the articles I just quoted in the first segment. You've got parents shouting down school boards, just trying to fight for removing pornography from the grade school library. This push to just indoctrinate the LGBT movement, to just pour that filth into the minds of our precious little ones. This is where we are today in education. And you have so many that work their way through the system, and then they graduate depressed and suicidal, or as a radical left-wing communist, hates their country, take to the streets, burn down businesses, and then you might get paid for it. As long as you're on the right side, as long as you're together with the communists, you might get $1 million payout. Look at the state of education today. I mean, even since he wrote that 23 years ago, I mean, think about 23 years ago, the year 2000, you didn't hear about how woke we needed to be. You didn't hear about LGBT. You didn't hear about, you know, critical race theory. It's so much worse today. And as he said, he was right. Writing in 2000, he said it's rapidly accelerating, this trend, this downward trend. It says here, the biggest area of disuse, he's talking about, again, the brain, or we would say the mind, the biggest area of disuse and so of decline is memory. Memory. As I say, he talks about how it was just particularly noticeable in his own lifetime. His mother, for example, when he was a boy, just committing things to his memory because she had it tucked away in her thinking. She had studied it. She had memorized it, whether it was portions of the Bible or poetry, literature, whatever it was. You think it's more advantageous for us to have that content dwelling in our minds than it is to just have it tucked away in your phone somewhere that you never go and get anyway because, well, there's too much on the phone to entertain you. There's too much texting that we've got to do in broken English. It says here, as aids to knowledge improve, the need for memory and other searching skills declines. In the Renaissance, a scholar might get only one opportunity to see a particular book or manuscript. He had to memorize its saliency or even the complete text. There were no elaborate techniques devised to help him do so. There were elaborate techniques. I mean, they really tried to work on their memory skills. It says, I doubt if there's anyone alive today who could repeat from memory even a sonnet after reading or hearing. At one time, thousands could do it. So what's changed? Well, you know what's changed about our society. You know, for one, that Satan has surcharged the air with his attitude and impulse, and he, more recently, with the information age that we've been in for the last several decades, I mean, he's just almost jammed the frequency on all the signals to where it's just a mass of confusion and noise and distraction. And people literally can't think. And yet they still make their way on TV saying the stupidest of things. changing their reasoning from one day to the next, divining motives. It says here, memory loss is serious because huge stores of knowledge in the mind, in instant tap, make possible creative connections, which are one symptom of high intellectual performance. Also in rapid decline today are search and discovery processes. We've really emphasized at this summer educational program just the importance of elevating the standard or the quality of our conversation and fellowship. There's a lot of time that we make a lot of time available for the young people to just talk to one another. But we give them instruction and we give them supervision as well. And we try to raise the standard. That automatically rises if you've put quality content into your thinking, into your minds. The Bible has a lot to say about true education. It has a lot to say about remembering. It has a lot to say about memory, even. Retaining. I mean, look at the sin of the Laodiceans in this final era of God's church. God says they didn't hold fast to their traditions, to the teachings of God, to the laws of God. They let it slip away and they became forgetful. There's a book of remembrance referred to in Malachi 3. A book of remembrance, and it's there because God puts names in there, the names of people who remember, who hold fast to these precious truths. I assigned Psalm 23. We'll see how successful this is. They've only got a week and a half left, but at the same time, it's just 118 words. But I told them, see if you can commit that to memory. This beautiful psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd." We've got three songs in our Bible hymnal that use the text from Psalm 23. I'll just read it here in case my memory fails me. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters." In my Bible, not the one I brought with me, but the one I took to the forum the other day, it says about Psalm 78, that this is a psalm, I'll get to that in just a second. Don't want to confuse you too much here up front, but it says this is a psalm about God being our guide. Psalm 23 is about God being our shepherd. We're just sheep. Sheep aren't very smart. We need God to lead us to green pastures. We need God to feed us, to educate us, to correct us, to love us. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. David says, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runneth over." It says, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the eternal forever. Beautiful words. Poetic words. We've got a class that is kicking in this fall semester on the poetry of the Bible. So much of the Bible, my father brings this out in the Form of Prophets book, so much of the Bible is poetry. Beautiful poetry, like what you just heard there from Psalm 23. I see the clock. I'll probably have to get to Psalm 78 tomorrow on the show. It reveals so much, the Psalms, the poems do, about God's mind, God's heart. Luke in Acts 13, he wrote that King David had a heart just like God's. King David made his mistakes. He committed some horrible sins. But that man knew how to repent toward God. He had a humble, repentant attitude, a heart like his great creator God. And he looked to God, as you can see from that psalm, we just read it. He looked to God as his shepherd, as his leader, as his master. And so must we. In Psalm 78, which we'll look at tomorrow, I mean, that's a psalm of remembrance. God wants us to remember how he delivered us out of this world, this present evil world. That's been a theme that's been running through this camp, out of this world. And of course, you can take it two ways. We're to come out of this present evil world, but what God has in store for us, the incredible human potential, it really and truly is literally out of this world. Look at what James Webb is revealing. This expansive, never-ending universe creation of God's. And it's not just out there, sitting there in vain. He's going to carry out his purpose, and it's going to touch every corner of this universe. The God family plan, the plan for beautifying and creating and maintaining, spreading God's way of life all over the world first and the wonderful world tomorrow, but then on out into the universe after that. Now God says, don't forget your miraculous beginning when God intervened. We'll see this next time. All of those miracles that God performed to release the ancient Israelites from captivity in Egypt. And Egypt, as Hebrews 11 brings out, it's a type of this world. When you come out of this world, think of scriptures like 2 Corinthians 6, the last few verses. God says, come out of this world and I'll receive you as a father. I'll receive you into my family. To come out of this world, as I told the campers the other day, I mean, it takes a miracle. It takes a series of miracles. We can't do it on our own strength and power. The Bible says that we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us. And so God wants us to put the focus on him and his power and the fact that he's our shepherd, our guide, and he's leading us to green pastures. Malachi 3:16, it says, then they that feared the eternal spoke often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the eternal and that thought upon his name. They fear God, and they're thinking about God's name and all that it represents. They're thinking about that family name. They're thinking about the truth of God. They're filling up their minds on God's word. And God takes note of them. As I say, this is a verse that is speaking of a book that we're going to be written into if we remember. My father says in Malachi's message, why a book of remembrance? This is not the book of life. It's a special book which concerns a unique group of people who fear the eternal and fellowship a lot. These are the Philadelphians who remembered. These are the Philadelphians who held fast to the traditions and the teachings of the great God. These are the ones who are filling up their minds, their spiritual memories, with God's truth, with God's word. We'll continue on with this study on tomorrow's show. We certainly appreciate you joining us for today's. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Email the show, td@thetrumpet.com. We'll see you again tomorrow.